It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. White House advisors once again saying North Korea will face destruction unless it ends its nuclear and missile programs. U.S. United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley told CNN North Korea is beginning to feel the pinch, but she is considering moving on from the diplomatic efforts and turning the matter over to U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis. U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster still seems to favor sanctions as the way to put pressure on Pyongyang.
Well, we may have to take some steps, though, that restrict trade in any way that we can with this regime, to choke off the resources that allow this regime to continue to prioritize their military efforts, their missile efforts, their nuclear efforts over the well-being of their own people.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has pledged to continue his weapons program, saying his country is nearing the goal of equilibrium in military force with the United States. North Korea will be high on the agenda for world leaders this week at their annual meeting of the UN General Assembly. Britain has eased its terrorist threat level from critical to severe after police arrested a second suspect in the bombing of a subway train in London. 21-year-old man was detained late Saturday under Britain's Terrorism Act. Earlier Saturday, an 18-year-old was arrested. Islamic State claimed responsibility for the Friday rush hour attack, the fifth this year in Britain. Tens of thousands of ethnic Oromo Ethiopians have been displaced in border clashes with ethnic Somalis, with reports indicating that dozens have been killed in the past week. The region has seen sporadic ethnic violence for decades. Sunday, Prime Minister deployed the army to quell the violence. This is VOA News. Hundreds of ultra-Orthodox Jews clashed with Israeli security forces in Jerusalem when an anti-military demonstration turned violent. Protesters were demonstrating against the arrest of a community member for refusing to enlist in the military. The issue has gained attention since Israel's Supreme Court struck down a 2015 law that granted exemptions from military service to ultra-Orthodox men. The Islamic militant group Hamas that rules Gaza said in a statement it will dissolve its administrative body and hold general elections. The decision is seen as a way to end a political and territorial rift between Hamas and President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement. We asked Randolph-Macon College Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach if this is significant.
Very significant. And if it actually happens, it would be extremely significant. Ever since the Palestinian elections for the parliament or the legislative council in 2006, Hamas and the ruling Fatah party, which has dominated Palestinian politics and certainly both the Palestine Liberation Organization and now the Palestinian Authority, that conflict has crippled the Palestinian body politic and has certainly made peace negotiations and a number of other things very, very complicated.
The news of the decision from Hamas comes after both Hamas and Fatah participated in recent separate talks with Egyptian intelligence officials in Cairo. Four young U.S. tourists were attacked with acid on Sunday at a train station in the French city of Marseille. French authorities said they don't think extremist views motivated a 41-year-old woman to throw the acid. Regional newspaper quoted unidentified police officials as saying that the woman had a history of mental health problems and did not try to flee the site of the attack. The governor of the U.S. state of Missouri warns his administration will deal harshly with those responsible for a violent protest in the city of St. Louis over the death of an African-American man at the hands of a white police officer who was acquitted of murder in the case. A number of people have been arrested, and the police chief in St. Louis, Lawrence O'Toole, said his police force will be diligent in responding to the violence.
We will continue to ensure our citizens' First Amendment rights are protected. However, we will not tolerate violence against citizens, police officers, or damage to property.
Small band of protesters began breaking windows and throwing objects at police over the weekend with Saturday clashes. More demonstrations are expected in the days ahead. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com. And we're always available on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, September the 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The DRC government announced that it launched an investigation into the armed clashes in which 37 Burundians and a junior Congolese army officer were killed on Friday in Kamanyola in the South Kivu province. And in the Gambia, lecturers and staffers of the country's only government-owned university, the Gambia College, have embarked on a sit-down strike.
An increment in their retention allowance, they want proper facilities, and also they want the mismanagement of the Gambia College in general. I think that is why they are on strike.
Dr. Ismail Sise is a political science professor at the Gambia College. And in Uganda, a civil society group says the election process where voters queue at polling centers is old-fashioned and deprives the electorate of their fundamental rights of a secret ballot, and they want the Constitutional Court to get rid of it.
So we need court to use its powers to halt the entire process, but also caution the rest of the powers, like Parliament, that look, we have all sorts of funds to have this process done very fairly.
Norman Tumuhimbise of the civil society group known as Concerned Ugandans. And in South Africa, a university student's financial account erroneously received a deposit of $1 million in a story that has captured both national and international headlines, raising all kinds of questions, including the moral question of what would you do if you erroneously received $1 million in your account? Those stories plus our sports roundup coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo announced that it has launched an investigation into the armed clashes in which 37 Burundian refugees and a junior Congolese army officer were killed on Friday in Kamanyola in the South Kivu province. Officials and local activists said that Congolese security forces killed at least 37 Burundian refugees and injured more than 100 others during confrontations on Friday over plans to return some of the refugees to their home country. Soldiers and police opened fire as the refugees tried to free some of their compatriots in Kamanyola, a town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo near the Burundi border. According to a witness, UN helicopters made at least 7 rotations to evacuate injured Burundians to Kavumbu, 80 kilometers from Kamanyola. Some seriously wounded were admitted to a hospital in Bukavu. According to a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, more than 2,000 Burundian refugees live in Kamanyola with host families. In a statement, Burundi's main opposition group, CNARED, accused Burundian army troops and members of the ruling CNDD-FDD's youth group Imbonerakure of carrying out the killings with the Congolese army. In the Gambia, lecturers and staffers of the country's only government-owned college, the Gambia College, have embarked on a sit-down strike. The college staffers are complaining about a lack of decent pay and poor working conditions. The protesters say that they have exhausted what they call all types of diplomatic negotiations with the Ministry of Higher Education before resorting to the strike action. Among their demands include a 75% graduate pay raise, among other benefits. Reporter Patnderi Mbai has this report.
The Gambia College Staff Association members said they will not return to work until their conditions are met. They are complaining about poor pay and poor working condition. Graduate allowance is one of their demands. They also want the teachers' allowance to be increased from 30% to 75%. Dr. Ismail Osise is a political science professor at the University of the Gambia. Dr. Sise comments on the plight of the protesting college faculty staffers.
You wouldn't know the deplorable conditions at Gambia College until you visit that campus. I mean, even a primary school should not be in that state. I mean, the toilets are despicable, the classrooms are poor with poor ventilation, nothing good in that place, and the salaries are so poor. So what they want now is an increment in their retention allowance, the improper facilities, and also they want the mismanagement of the Gambia College in general. I think that is why they are striking.
But some supporters of the new government said it is too early for the Gambia College staffers to demand for pay raise. They cited the current economic mess the Barrow government inherited from the former German dictatorship. But Professor Sisi disagrees.
I think those people who make such statements are misinformed. They are ignorant of the facts because they are not on the ground. These Gambia College lecturers, they know what they are going through. I think the government has also failed in some aspect to come with a clear higher education strategy in terms of how they want to transform the higher education system. And this is missing. I mean, nobody can tell us it is that tell this staff it is too early. I mean, these are the staff who are on the ground. I mean, we are working in conditions that are deplorable.
Dr. Sisi said the government should instead embark on educational reform program than embracing the previous policies of the Jammeh regime. He says the current education policy is below standards. He also says the Gambia needs total educational reform in the interest of quality education. Sisi said the average university lecturer earns less than $300 salary per month, while PhD holders are earning $500. He said professors' salaries should be increased so that they can live a dignified life. Demba Ali Jawo is Gambia's communication and information minister.
I honestly do not have much idea as to, you know, what their demands are and how justified or unjustified their demands are. I definitely need to know much about what is going on.
President Adama Barrow left Banjul on Sunday for New York City to attend the United Nations General Assembly Summit. His government has come under increasing criticism lately for failing to fix the country's economic crisis. Mr. Barrow came to power in December of 2016 after defeating Gambia's longtime dictator Yahya Jammeh in a highly contested elections. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Drone usage in Rwanda is growing, and Tanzania is set to launch the largest domestic drone network in the world next year. While drones can help improve access to the internet, healthcare, and more, there are concerns. Many drone operations are international companies that use Africa as a testing ground for their technology. Timothy Rota, head of Civo Drones at the World Economic Forum, says that while this provides training and exposure opportunities, an important next step is to incubate domestic providers and manufacturers inside Africa so that Africans can capture a bigger slice of the value chain. Reuters spoke to Ricky Shryok about some of the benefits and concerns around the takeoff of drones in Africa.
Drone usage will have an impact on internet access in Africa. However, that's not likely to happen in the next year. A lot of these technologies are fairly experimental. The Facebook Aquila program is developing a high altitude, long endurance drone that will communicate across a network using lasers. And a lot of that technology is still being developed. There's also the Google Project Loon, which is creating a mesh network in the air using balloons.
In another area, how are the drones being used for healthcare needs? I know Tanzania next year is slated to develop one of the biggest, if not the biggest, national network of drones being used in the healthcare arena, I believe.
So there's a tremendous amount of innovation going on around drones in the healthcare space, which seems to be focused around East Africa. So the most famous example, in Rwanda, the government partnered with a U.S.-based company called Zipline, which is delivering blood to remote clinics from a central facility. I was there last week, and they explained to us how they've already had 1,000 patient lives impacted. One of the most important uses of that is helping women during childbirth who have significant bleeding and need transfusions. And Rwanda has been the first country to do this at national scale. As you noted, its program is now expanding into Tanzania, which is going to have a much bigger network. But beyond those two use cases, there have been trials in Madagascar with a company called Vayu, where they were picking up blood samples to do testing at a central facility. And in Malawi, a company called MatterNet was doing similar work, and UNICEF recently partnered with the government of Malawi to create a humanitarian corridor to test different applications for drones.
What are the possibilities of using drones for conservation efforts?
One of the most high-profile conservation efforts with drones has been around counter-poaching applications, but nobody has yet definitively demonstrated that this use case works. And a lot of it really has to do with the social factors that surround poaching. So there's not simply a technical solution.
Are there dangers to drone usage? What are some of those dangers?
The concerns that people have in Africa are the same ones that people in the United States have. So I was talking with a bunch of Rwandan youth, and they brought up the same privacy concerns that I would have heard in a bar in San Francisco.
That was Timothy Rota, head of civil drones at the World Economic Forum. He was speaking to Ricky Shryuk from San Francisco. A civil society group has petitioned the Constitutional Court of Uganda, asking for the courts of law to cancel the forthcoming local election, commonly known by the acronym LC. A pressure group known as Concerned Ugandans wants the court to nullify the entire election process, where voters are expected to queue. They say that the practice is old-fashioned and deprives the electorate of their fundamental rights of a secret ballot. From Kampala, Uganda, Mugume Davis Rakarinji has this story.
Chief petitioner Norman Tumhimse told journalists that the Uganda Electoral Commission, a body responsible for organizing elections in the country, should cancel the ongoing electoral process of local council leaders expected in November this year. Tumhimse says queuing up will set a bad precedent for future elections in the country.
So we need court to use its powers to halt the entire process, but also caution the rest of the powers, like parliament, that look, we have all sorts of funds to have this process done very fairly.
LC1 is responsible for a village in the case of urban areas, a neighborhood. The last LC1 and LC2 elections were organized in 2001, and the government has already said it did not have enough funds to organize these elections. Tumhimse says queuing up will only create a lot of tension and insecurity in the country.
People fear for their lives. You see women being, murdered in broad daylight. Now imagine if they queued up, if they queued behind some person. So meaning, if you want to protect the citizens and this nation, you need to have a secret ballot where no one will know who voted who.
Hamisi Musoke, a member of this pressure group, agrees. He says queuing up brings along with it intimidation and fear.
So we are worried and looking at people who will not vote. They are fellow landlords, and in the end, when someone after that very election, the person will be chased out of the house. We are looking at married people. A man may be a candidate in this very race, and a woman may not be in position of running behind her. The end, the marriage will broke.
In 2014, Uganda Parliament passed a bill providing for lining up behind candidates during elections for LC1 and LC2 levels, as opposed to universal adult suffrage through a secret ballot. Another member, Ivan Manyali, says queuing up may cause a lot of social evils in the society.
People are likely to fight any time, any moment, because if, let's say, candidate A and candidate B are at the same point, then the supporters or the voters of candidate A or candidate B may come interact, and then they end up fighting, and it creates hatred.
He says the Electoral Commission should respect the LC elections just like it does for major elections in the country, because local leaders are the foundation of justice, law and order. LCs are comprised of 11 members that preside over small cases, dispute resolution and mediation. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In South Africa, a university student's account erroneously received a deposit of $1 million in her financial aid account in a story that has captured both national and international headlines. The student spent more than $60,000 of the fortune before authorities realized the mistake. Now the country's parliament is involved. I reached reporter Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa, for details on this rather interesting story that raises many questions, including moral ones. Now, Nadia, I read that the student was supposed to get a stipend of around $100, but she ended up with a lot more than that. And now she's in hot water after spending some of that cash. What is the story here, Nadia?
Quite right, Jackson. A student in her early 20s called Sibongile Mani erroneously received a windfall in her account. Instead of getting her usual 1,400 monthly allowance, she received a whopping 1.4 million rand. So she was meant to receive around $104 US. Instead, she finds $106,000 in her bank account. What does she do? She goes on a massive spending spree. She buys cell phones, designer clothing, expensive weaves, and flies her and her friends around the country to attend lavish events. Now, the card linked to the student financial aid account is meant to be used at book retailers and at food stores only. It's essentially a sustenance account for students on financial aid. So several questions are spinning around at this stage. How did she manage to make these elaborate purchases, and how did the error come about? While several parties try to figure that out, Intelimani, which manages the student funds, has laid criminal charges against the young woman. It's also again raised the issue around why the South African government is still using third parties to pay out state funds, and why the use of middlemen is still so prevalent. We know that the government is currently using a third party to pay out social grants to old age pensioners and disability grant recipients. And that's another controversial topic currently under review. But the latest student funding issue has really put a spotlight on this matter.
Now, we understand that the South African Parliament is getting involved, trying to figure out just how the money ended up in the student account. Is that correct?
Well, Jackson, that's the $1 million. Or should I say the $1.4 million question? The matter's getting national attention. On Wednesday, various role players appeared before Parliament to account for what went wrong here. It's a massive oversight, and it was only picked up a few months after the fact. Nobody really wants to take the blame. The Walter Sisulu University, the service provider in Telimali, and the National Student Financial Aid Scheme are all insisting that there's no dodgy business going on here, that there was no corruption, that this was purely an honest error. Members of Parliament are having none of it. They say employees in all of those organizations must be investigated and that the blame cannot be placed firmly at the student's door. They've raised the issue that control systems must be poor at Intelimani, which pays the stipends on behalf of the financial aid scheme, if their auditing processes fail to pick up this rather massive blunder, which they did. They failed to pick up the blunder for months after the fact.
This rather interesting story, Nadia, has captured international headlines. I can imagine it's making national headlines in South Africa. What are her fellow students at the university saying, and what is the public in general saying in South Africa?
Well, Jackson, the story was actually revealed through her fellow university students who became suspicious of Sibongile Mani's sudden change of lifestyle. There were new phones, expensive clothing, plane tickets to flashy events. Eventually, someone picked up her ATM slip after she used an auto bank at a grocery store and saw her staggering bank balance. They then alerted authorities, and that's how the matter came to light. Now, the public is divided on this one. Some feel the error is not her fault, that she should not be made to pay back the money, saying she's young, she's just starting out her adult life, and this massive debt would be hanging over her head. Others feel she absolutely should have known the money did not belong to her. She did not work for the money. She did not sign up for a student loan agreement that would give her that much money. She knew something was wrong and she had no right to spend it. So we've got a very much a public opinion that's pretty split on this one. The student's grandmother, interestingly, is quoted in a newspaper saying, If she got all this money, why didn't she build me a better house? I'm living in poverty. The implication there being, it's fine that she got this money by some dodgy means, but why didn't she come and help me with that cash? And so it's really raised a debate, Jackson, around morals, about what constitutes theft, and about the repercussions that one should face in this instance.
That was Nadia Sami. She was speaking to me from Johannesburg, South Africa. And now it's time for Sports Roundup with Samson O'Malley in Abuja. Good morning, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the results of the first leg quarterfinal matches in the CAF Confederations Cup played across various venues on the continent this past weekend. Holders TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo moved a step closer towards a semi-final spot following their 2-1 win against Al Hilal Obeid in Sudan on Saturday. It was a bad weekend for Tunisia as their two representatives, Club Africain and CS Faxien, suffered defeats on the road. Club Africain lost by a lone goal away to Algeria's MC Alger in Algiers, with Nekashi Hashim's first half strike separating the two sides. Elsewhere in Rabat, Karim Benarif's 19th minute penalty was all FCUS Rabat needed to beat Sfaxien for a narrow first leg advantage. Early on Friday, SuperSport United of South Africa and Zambian's Zesco United settled for a barren draw in Pretoria. The second leg matches will take place next weekend. In the CAF Champions League, defending champion Mamelodi Sundowns take a 1-0 advantage into the second leg of their 2017 CAF Champions League quarterfinals against Wydad Casablanca next week. The defending champions will take the slender lead into their second leg in Morocco in a week's time. On Saturday, it finished 1-1 between Mozambique Ferroviário de Beira and USM Alger, and it was 2-2 between record 8-time winners Al Ahly of Egypt and Tunisia's Esperance. Now to women's football. Nigeria, Ghana and Cameroon confirmed their superiority with convincing win in the first round, first leg matches of the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup France 2018 qualifiers over the weekend. Cameroon were the biggest winners thanks to a 9-0 drubbing of Guinea away in Conakry on Saturday, while Nigeria made light work of Tanzania with a 3-0 win in Benin City. Earlier on Friday, Ghana's Black Princess proved too strong for host Algeria, handing them a 5-0 beating in Algiers. Elsewhere in Kenya, the national under-20 women's football team came from behind to score two late vital away goals as they held Ethiopia to a 2-2 draw in Hawassa. And now to other sports, we begin with basketball, where Tunisia claimed their second FIBA AfroBasket title after beating Nigeria 77-65 in Saturday's final in Tunis. Earlier in the day, Senegal claimed the last spot on the podium after seeing off Morocco 73-62 in the third-place game. Nigeria's Ike Diogo was named the tournament's most valuable player. In marathon news, Ethiopian Assefa Nigewo has retained his title by again storming to victory in the Salam Cape Town Marathon. Nigewo is the first man ever to win the race 2 years in succession. He charged away from his competitors and ended the race in 2 hours, 2 minutes and 1 second. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, September the 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the 72nd United Nations General Assembly opens with a theme focusing on people, striving for peace and a decent life for all on a sustainable planet. Host Shaka Sali and his guest will discuss the UNGA's theme and its importance for the people of Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.